This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. When it comes to what she thinks may be the biggest challenge that parents of boy children face, today's guest likes to point to Mark Twain. Well, more specifically, the character created by Twain, Tom Sawyer. As our guest is fond of noting, if Tom Sawyer taught us anything, it's that if you try to do a boy's work for him, that boy will let you. So perhaps the most important piece of advice in our guest's newest book may also be the hardest for parents to follow. Don't do your boy's work for him. Be willing to let him fail until he figures out that he has to do it himself. But this is the fourth book our guest has now written on differences between boys and girls, so you can bet it's chock full of other tips too. And we'll get to as many of them as we can with education psychologist Abigail Norfleet James when we examine her just published Parents' Guide to Boys right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Are you now, or have you ever been, the parent of a boy child? Are you now, or have you ever been a boy yourself? Is there something that you may have learned through either of these experiences that you think it might be important for the rest of us to know? Something that could help more young children experience more success in school and in life? 888-WMRA. Talk is how to reach us by phone. Now, we also want to hear from you if you should have any type of question about raising boys, especially if you've ever encountered a male child who's had trouble in school. 888-967-2825. Educational psychologist Dr. Abigail Norfleet James is making a return visit to help us out and also to reveal some of the insights shared in her latest book, The Parent's Guide to Boys. Dr. James, great to see you back in the Insight Studio.
Thrilled to be here.
Abigail, before we dive into your book, could we talk a little bit more about Mark Twain and Tom Sawyer?
Have at it. Well, the point is that Mark Twain wrote some of the best boy characters known to man. The stories that he writes about Tom and Huck and their buddies are dynamite. And as with everything that Twain does, he has phenomenal insight into what's going on. And the whole story of Tom Sawyer and Painting the Fence is just such a classic point that here, if a boy can get somebody else to do his work for him, he will.
Can you remind us a little bit about what goes on in that famous scene?
Well, Tom's required to paint the fence out in front of the house where he's living. And his buddies come along, and Tom figures out a way to say, oh, no, this is too hard for you. You could never do this. So what he does is he makes it sound like it's a really cool thing to do. And eventually, he gets somebody else takes over because, oh, no, I can do this too. It's a challenge. And that's the other part of the boy thing, is that let's make it a challenge, and then it's more fun.
So, and you bring this point up fairly early in your new book, Abigail, that parents are awfully tempted for a lot of reasons to help their boy children by doing the work for them.
Yeah. And you got to, if you will just please, when your son says to you, oh, I can't do this, or it's too hard, or something like that, put Tom Sawyer right across your son's face and a paintbrush in his hand, because it ain't going to be long before you're painting the fence for him. Boys are good at getting other people to do their work for them. I always say to parents, if you're helping your child with his homework and there's a pencil in your hand, put it down. You should not be doing the work. The only job you should be doing is saying, here's the piece of paper. You need a pencil? Go get one over there. You don't get the pencil for him. Make him go get the pencil. Will he drag his feet? Yes, he will. Does that mean that you get frustrated? He hopes you will, because he's doing everything for you to do it. And the more you don't, then he's going to have to learn to do it himself. And boys, the funny thing is that when it comes to something they like to do, they are speed demons at it. One of my favorite points is the boy who won't do his homework will spend all Saturday afternoon practicing shooting baskets. Literally, he will spend 4 hours outdoors shooting baskets because he can see the progress, because he wants to do it, because it's satisfying to him. The problem with school is he can't see his progress. It's very frustrating. And his skill set isn't designed as well to do school as it is to shoot baskets. And he's more comfortable shooting baskets.
This new book of yours, like your previous three, all of which you've been here over the past 8 years to discuss
with
us. I
have. Well, one of them I haven't, but yeah.
It is fun to read, and there are some laugh out loud moments. I think my favorite may have been when you said something near the end of the book of your child's homework is not supposed to earn you a grade. It's for him a grade, although there certainly have been times when you've been tempted to grade the parent.
I have.
Because as a teacher, you could tell that the parents were doing the homework. But you got started in this series of books about gender learning. You've written books now both about how boys learn and about how girls learn, although this is your first book specifically for parents. There's some controversy here, I think, Abigail, because for a long time, many of us have been hearing that it was girls who were disadvantaged in school. And in fact, I think there's a famous book in the early 1990s called Failing at Fairness that really got that conversation started.
Absolutely. And that was a very valid point. The research that underpins Failing at Fairness pointed out that teachers call on boys more often in class, and that teachers praise boys for what they do and girls for the way their work looks, both of which are very undermining to girls and to boys. But the point is that what the Sadkers failed to recognize was that the reason that teachers call on boys more often is it's a classroom management technique, because otherwise they're blurting out answers and it was a way to control them. The ways that that we had a problem with, we also said to girls, science and math are, you don't have to worry about it, honey. And what's really interesting is in 1900, science and math were classes for girls. Boys were supposed to be good at the hard stuff, literature, languages, Greek, Latin, etc. And they weren't to worry their pretty little heads over science and math. Well, along came, I think probably about World War I, technology begins to be important. And all of a sudden, the men take over the science and math. And why society wants to make one for one group and one for another is ridiculous. The research is really clear. Girls do really well in math. They don't do it the same way that boys do, but they do it really well. But I'll tell you how pervasive this is. I've been in South Africa working with schools there, and children who go to school in buildings that, you know, don't look like what I would call a traditional school building, their girls get the point that girls are not supposed to be good in math and science. And so there was a very valid issue, and I still maintain that teaching girls is harder than teaching boys, because girls won't tell you when they don't get it. You say, did you get it? And you get this big smile, and yes, ma'am, and I did, and they didn't. They want to be positive towards their teachers. Whereas if a boy doesn't get it, you're the first person who knows it, or maybe the second after he does. Boys are very, very clear that, no, I didn't get it. And what's happened is that all of the way we teach has been focused on girls, and we've now lost boys. And we also, because of the high-stakes testing, now we have this huge emphasis on verbal skills. And that's where boys lose out, is that it's the verbal skills because of the way their brains are structured at the beginning and because of what parents aren't necessarily doing.
The book is titled The Parent's Guide to Boys, Help Your Son Get the Most Out of School and Life. Its author, Dr. Abigail Norfleet James, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you want to talk to Dr. James, we've got a phone line open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Abigail, one of the things that in all of your books you keep coming back to is this absolute clarity that you have in your mind, although some other researchers disagree,
yep,
that there are biological differences between boys and girls that affect, especially at early ages, how they learn, what they learn easily, and what they're most likely to struggle with. Although you also say something about height.
Well, my point is that if I say to people, men are taller than women, everybody agrees, even though they understand that not all men are taller than all women. I'm 5'10". That's the average height of a man. So I'm taller than many men. So if I say that boys learn this way and girls learn that way, I don't understand why people get all bent out of shape over the fact that not all do. Absolutely not all do. I'm my best example. I have the brain of a 14-year-old boy with better verbal skills. I learn best by looking at things, by handling things, by doing things. I learn least well by listening. And I learn moderately well by reading. So I have this problem that the real issue is that we're dealing with scientists who have never been in a classroom. I've been in a classroom for 30-plus years. I know what it's like to have a classroom of 10-year-old boys and girls, and they are not the same. And when I say to teachers, look, I have to cover myself these days and say to you, the research on this is not everybody agrees. All the teachers look at me and say, you got to be kidding. We all know that there's this difference. And they get the fact that they're not talking about a dichotomous set. We're not talking about boys in one corner and girls in the other.
So tell us some about some of these things that you say boys, for the most part, mm-hmm. have with them as part of their biology, especially early on, that make verbal skills difficult, that they come to those types of things like reading and verbal fluency later than girls.
All right. Well, with boys particularly, there's a real sort of confluence of problems. The day that children are born, in general, the left side of the brain is developing a little faster in girls, the right side a little faster in boys. The left side of the brain is where the verbal center begins. We think that's probably the reason why a 20-month-old girl has twice the vocabulary of a 20-month-old boy. On average, you know, we try to do this, not every child. So first of all, you've got the fact that boys are coming to language a little later. One of my problems is that people say, yeah, but by the time you get to be about 15, there's no difference. Because if I give children a test for verbal intelligence in high school, there's no difference. And my point is, yes, I know there is no difference because the test is written so that there's no difference. We absolutely do not know according to those tests because they are carefully structured to be gender neutral.
But one of the things that you really stress in your book is the experience that boys have at the age of 3, 4, 5, and 6, especially once they start school.
Right.
And they find that they're having difficulty learning, difficulty meeting the kinds of educational demands that are typical in a school.
Yeah, that's a real issue.
That long before they get to the age of 15, they may have incorporated within themselves a belief that they can't learn.
That's right. And they turn it off early. And that's my point to parents is your job is not to teach your kid. Your job is to help your child navigate and negotiate the verbal world by giving him a lot of verbal skills. Number one, read to your kid every single night. And I'm not kidding.
Read
to your child every single night from the day your child comes home from the hospital. You read to him or talk to him. And what I get from parents is, but he's not paying attention because many little boys don't look at you when you're talking to them. Say, yeah, I know that. He's not looking at you, but he's listening.
Yeah, you talk some, I suspect that there are mothers in the audience who are going to identify with this, even though maybe they have wondered what was going on, about how their boy child will not look them in the face, but will be constantly bumping up against them.
So
I'm going to ask you to explain that and how that translates into what we need to know about how to help boys learn better when we continue our discussion with Abigail Norfleet James, author of the new book, The Parent's Guide to Boys. I think we also have a Facebook question coming up from Sue, so we'll get to that. And the phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. We'll be back in a bit more than 1 minute. In addition to her work as a teacher, consultant, and researcher, educational psychologist Abigail Norfleet James does a lot of writing about sex-based learning styles. Among her previous titles, Teaching the Male Brain, How Boys Think, Feel, and Learn in School, Teaching the Female Brain, How Girls Learn Math and Science, as well as Active Lessons for Active Brains, Teaching Boys and Other Experiential Learners. Her newest book, The Parent's Guide to Boys, Help Your Son Get the Most Out of School and Life, is our focus this hour. And this thing about little boys bumping up against mom, even though mom thinks they're not paying attention.
One of the things is that if you have a little girl, she's sitting on the floor in the kitchen and, you know, doing whatever she's doing, and mom's cooking, and she looks at her daughter, and there's this connection, this visual connection between their eyes. Mom smiles, little girl smiles back. It's like, oh, mom's looking at me. That's great. And the little boy in the same position is probably banging on pots and throwing things and running around, and he doesn't look like he's paying much attention to mom. And mom sometimes can feel a little left out because her son's not really joining, and she says something to him in her nice inside voice, you know, honey, what are you doing? And he doesn't even answer her. But he's constantly bumping up against her because boys need that physical contact. And that's another part of the reading to the kid every night, is that's part of that physical contact. That when you make that sort of connection with your child, that he can trust you, that you're there physically for him, you have made a connection that will last a lifetime.
So sit him in your lap, or at least be touching him while you're reading to him.
You can be right there.
And yeah. You said something before that comes up several times in your book about that soft indoor voice and the reason why boys have trouble with that.
Well, one of the factors is that we know that as of the day boys and girls are born, little boys' ears don't respond as rapidly to soft and high sounds. So mom's using her soft inside voice, and it may just not be loud enough for a little boy, particularly if he's got a streamy nose, he's got a little cold. We know that boys are more likely to have ear infections than girls are. So their ears may be, particularly when they're teething, and all the moms out there will go, yeah, I've been wiping my son's nose forever. And they don't hear as well. And so you need to be a little louder around a boy. What may actually, for a girl, seem loud enough. One of the things when I talk about teaching girls is I talk to parents, as I say to dads, has your daughter ever said to you, hey, mom, daddy's yelling at me, and you weren't. You were just using your pay attention to me voice, and I get a lot of nods on that one because men have a voice that's a little louder when they mean to be paid attention to. You need to use that when you're talking to a boy, and it's not yelling at him. He won't take it badly. He will say, oh, you mean for me to pay attention to you. That's it. I come from a long line of loud people, so I get boys pay attention to me.
But part of the point you're saying is that there's fairly good evidence that boys, at least early in life,
yes,
do not hear as well as girls
right.
do. They also have trouble with colors?
Well, more. There are 10% of males are much more likely to be colorblind than females are. And as a matter of fact, 10% of people are colorblind. Almost all of them are male. It's very rare that you find a woman who is colorblind. It's a sex-linked characteristic, and you have to get it from both mom and dad, and it has to be the same kind for a woman to be colorblind. I have a colorblind son, and my brother is colorblind, and they both have exactly the same colorblindness, which is a profound red-green. They cannot tell the difference in traffic lights.
But even without being technically colorblind, you say, Abigail, that males, at least young males, often have trouble differentiating between shades of colors compared to girls.
The new research says that males don't, we've known for a long time men don't report as many colors. And research that came out last year talks about the fact that males don't actually see shades that are different as much as little girls do. So when I'm talking to people who teach at boys' schools, I say, let's use some primary colors. If you're going to use salmon colored paper, at least call it pink. You know, they'll get the light color, but these shades of color just, you know, and this is why, ladies, if you say to your husband, you know, do these colors match? And for him, he says yes. And you go outdoors and they plainly don't yell at him. He just didn't see it. Okay.
The other thing about seeing is that there's something that I'd actually never heard of before, Abigail Norfleet James, that is it called saccades?
Saccades.
And it has to do with how much you see, including when you're reading words on a page.
Right.
Part of the problem for boys is they see too much?
Yeah, some do, not many, but there are a few who do. If you actually could see what you would see, you'd be horrified because you only focus in actually a very small central part of your vision. That part is in color and clear. And there's two holes in your vision where your optic nerves leave, where you can't see at all. Then there's an outside edge of that that's in color but fuzzy. And then the outside edge is black and white. You don't even see color out in the corners of your eyes. And people say to me, oh, yes, I do. And I say, no. What you have is saccades. Your eyes move back and forth very slightly, constantly. And you have a very good memory. So what happens is your brain's making it up. And if you don't believe me, go someplace and stare very hard. Do not move your eyes. And look and think about somebody who's in the periphery of your vision who has on a color. And see if you can actually remember what the color was. And you can't look. Just in your periphery, and you're going to be shocked that you may have forgotten what that color is.
And how this relates to reading is that boys who develop reading problems sometimes simply can't compute the number of words that they're seeing?
No, we know that there are children, both boys and girls, who have very large saccades. Their eyes literally, you can see them jump. And those children, their eyes go over so far. When you're reading, your eyes are moving back and forth, which is why you can tell what's coming up when you're reading, so that you know that there's a pause coming up or there's a comma or a period. And so when you're reading, you make sense of it. You don't read one letter, one word at a time. The child who has really bad saccades has a very large reading disability, and they lose words, they lose where they are on the page. They literally can't keep track of words in a line. There is some evidence that some boys have larger than normal saccades, but not large enough to qualify for the learning disability. These are boys who start to learn to read pretty well, but when the print gets smaller, long about grade 3, they don't make progress. And so one of the theories is that if you could just bump the print up a little bit, they'll read. As they grow, these boys' eyes will get control over them and they will get better.
In general, are boys more likely to have reading problems early on than
girls? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No question about
that.
No, the reason is that they don't develop verbal skills as quickly as girls do, of all varieties. I mean, it's not surprising that boys are more likely to be dyslexic because they simply don't have the verbal skills to begin with. On the other hand, boys do really well with spatial skills, much better than girls. But we don't see those lack of spatial skills as a learning disability early. It's not until we run into girls having trouble with geometry that we begin to realize, oops, back in kindergarten, we should have been letting those girls play with three-dimensional objects and build things. Because now that they get into high school and they're having troubles with geometry, now it's a problem.
Help Your Son Get the Most Out of School and Life is the subtitle of Abigail Norfleet James' newest book. The primary title, The Parent's Guide to Boys. So what are some of the things that you most want to stress that parents of boys need to know to help those boys get the most?
Read to them. If you do nothing else, read to your kid every night. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily mom has to read to a kid. When our son was little, I was teaching at a boys' boarding school, and so I was gone frequently at night, and my husband read to him. And I began to realize that my son realized that reading was something that men do. So he needs to have his dad read to him, or if there isn't a dad or a residential male, find one somewhere, a grandfather, an uncle, a next-door neighbor. One of my favorite remarks is that Dennis the Menace spends far more time with Mr. Wilson next door than he does with his own dad, and that's fine. Number two is talk to your kid. Talk to him every day. Talk to him constantly. Be a chatty.
Can you give some examples about the sort of imaginative talk rather than talking at engaging in dialogue with an 18-month-old baby?
Well, for example, when I was changing my child's diapers, he'd be babbling along and I would say, have you read the newspaper today? And he's babbling a little bit. And I said, well, I don't know whether you're right about that. I thought about this. I'm carrying on English and he's babbling, but he's learning how to carry on a conversation. I talk, you talk, I talk. You ask a question, you go up on the end. You're firm, you go down on the end of the sentence. And I want to engage with you. And the minute he started including words in there, I was thrilled and let him know. You have to understand that by the time a child is 8 months old, experts can tell what language that child has been around, that already the babbles are limited to the sounds of the language in that child's environment. Not only that, but the child who watches a substantial amount of TV has a slower rate of verbal development. Research on that is real clear, that the child who watches a lot of TV, even if it is those so-called educational programs to help children develop verbal skills, it actually slows down the development of verbal skills.
So a three-year-old boy watching Sesame Street, or a girl, is not going to learn verbal skills as fast as if that time was spent being read to.
Or being talked to by mom. I mean, when I was taking my son for a walk, I was constantly, he's babbling along and I'm saying, oh, look, there's the bluebirds. You remember the bluebirds from yesterday? You know, my son's lucky, he has a chatty mother. I can talk to anybody about anything. I would talk about my job. I would talk about what I was doing. I would talk about everything that was going along, anything. And what I began to realize was the more I talked, the more he babbled and eventually talked. And I now have a son who's extremely verbal, according to his female friends.
Our guest on this edition of Virginia Insight, educational psychologist Abigail Norfleet James. Her newest book is titled The Parent's Guide to Boys. And I should ask, is there anything that you listening have ever found about boys that confused you? If you'd be willing to share that story, you can reach us by phone at 888-WMRA-TALK. We're looking primarily at boys and school and their developmental stages as they grow up, but we'd be happy to entertain related questions as well. We have this from Sue on our Facebook page, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight on Facebook. Sue says, a friend is dating a widower with three children. She gets along fine with the two girls, but the middle child, a nine-year-old boy, has been a challenge. Any suggestions for how a potential new stepmom can warm things up with a boy in that age group?
Boys don't warm up rapidly, particularly a boy who's entering puberty. He's skeptical. He has seen a lot of people come and go, and he's not necessarily in that particular relationship, but it takes a long time. He actually may be warming up to her and she doesn't know it. And that wouldn't surprise me in the slightest, because he's not as conventionally female chatty with her. His sisters are probably, oh yes, da 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 da, and walking on talking about all kinds of stuff, and he's just sitting in the back. And she's seeing that as a child who is being resistant to warming up, when in fact he may be warming up a lot and she's just not aware of it. What she needs to do is to spend some time with him, and she needs to be consistent, and she needs to be very honest with him. You know, I'm not your mom. I'm never going to be your mom, but I can be somebody else that would help. I'm here for you, man. And it's a hard kind of thing if you're not used to talking to boys. What she may want to do is ask a friend who has a son of about the same age and talk with him about what he thinks a boy would be interested in.
All boys of all ages love to throw things?
They do. Basketball is a famous sport.
And you maintain that a man cannot crumple up a piece of paper without trying to make two points into the wastebasket?
Probably a grown-up man can, but you know, even my husband in his office, he thinks he's dropping it into the paper in the waste bin next to him, and it's 2 points, even if it's one-handed.
Boys often seem to say that the teacher doesn't like me.
Absolutely.
Or even the teacher hates me.
Mm-hmm.
And you point out in this book, Dr. James, that how a boy feels about his relationship with his teacher is often much more important than how a girl feels about her relationship with her teacher.
Yeah. And the research on this is very clear and robust. Girls will work for people they don't like because they are able to discipline themselves, and they also have a way of competing with themselves for a personal best, what's called it's a different form of competition. And boys have a hard time with that. Boys, because of the high amygdala in little boys, the amygdala is the part of our brain that enables us to manage strong emotions. And it develops more rapidly in little boys. The fact that a boy has to feel that people like him and that he likes that. A boy will work at something he's not successful at because he likes it. Boys will work for people, for teachers, who they have a hard time in their class, but they think the teacher is on their side. The teacher's willing to work for them. And I've worked really hard at trying to figure out why boys say to teachers, you know, why a boy would say the teacher doesn't like me, because I've talked to the teachers who've said, I never said that. I don't dislike the child. I like him fine. So what happened? And a couple of things happened. One is the boy didn't do his work and he got called on the carpet and he didn't like that. That's truthfully his own fault, but he's not going to see it that way. But more importantly, what I find is the teacher who's saying, I want you to do this work this way. And it doesn't work for the boy to do it that way. So, for example, the teacher says, read this material, and tomorrow we're going to take a test on it. And the boy's reading skills aren't very good, or it's a really boring book, and he's not interested in it. So his point is, the teacher, who is smart, ought to know better. Therefore, if the teacher's making him work this way, she must hate me. Makes sense to him.
And I want to go back to make sure I was understanding what you were just saying, Abigail, is if a boy feels that a teacher likes him, mm-hmm. or the boy admires the teacher and feels like mm-hmm. he has an emotional connection with the teacher, even if he's not very good at reading, even if he's not very good at writing or anything,
right.
that that particular teacher that has his affection and has his respect, he's willing to keep at it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is key. It is the hardest burden you carry as the teacher of boys, that particularly for young boys, that if they work hard, it's you.
Is there something in that nature of boys that we've just touched on that parents can use?
Oh, yeah. One of the things that you have to understand is that boys want to please their parents, but they don't want to please them in the ways that girls do, which is right up front. Boys want their parents to be proud of them. That really matters to a boy. And that if you can, but don't use guilt to get that across, because you'll just shut him down. You can't guilt a boy into something. You can, I have to admit, I'm very embarrassed about it. I've used guilt on girls, but I can't use it on boys. It won't work.
Well, we want to talk some more about what does work. We also have some calls coming in, and we will have time to take a few more calls. I think we've still got one line open at 888-WMRA-TALK. So if you have questions or thoughts about boys that you'd be willing to share with us, we will get to you after we get to Aaron and Rick after this break. Our guest on this edition of Virginia Insight, educational psychologist Abigail Norfleet James. Our newest book, titled The Parent's Guide to Boys, Help Your Son Get the Most Out of School and Life. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and we're going next to Vesuvius. Aaron, thanks for calling in. Your question, your comment, please.
Hi, thanks. I have two boys. They're age 7 and 10, and I do read to them every night as often as I can, probably 20 to 25 nights out of a month. And I'm just wondering, is there an age at which I'm doing them a disservice to read to them? Should I be sending them up to read to themselves? I mean, they continue to want me to read to them, and I enjoy it, but
shouldn't they be doing it? Keep at it. Keep at it. I always say, read to your son until he tells you to stop. What you're doing is you're getting this wonderful connection with your sons that I don't know that you get any other way. And you're saying to your sons, I'm a trustworthy parent. I'm here for you. And you can count on me. And you're also giving him books that books they couldn't or wouldn't read on their own. For example, my husband used to read to our son all the books on Redwall, which contain the words in the Redwall books. An 8-year-old loves them, but he can't read it because they're English book. They're English terms, and they don't know them. But what my son got was the sense of how language sounds. One of the problems that teachers have is that children don't get the fact that written language is different from spoken language. And the child who is read to late gets that difference and understands and has an affection for written language. And I can't tell you what an advantage you're giving your sons. So keep reading to them as long as they'll let you.
Okay. Thank you.
A great question, Aaron. Thanks so much. To you on the other side of your radio, do you have boy children? Is there something about their needs, wants, ways of learning that has struck you as particularly noteworthy? We've got the phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. But since our guest has also done research into and written about how girls learn best, we're happy to hear your questions and comments on that side of the parenting and teaching equation as well. 888-967-2825. Next to Stanton. Rick, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for Abigail Norfleet James, please.
Yes, you'd mentioned that at 8 months, it was able to determine what the native language infant had been exposed to. And I just read in the February 9th issue of Science News that they have tested infants between 7 and 75 hours after birth. Have been able to determine what their native language vowels they had been exposed to.
Yep. The deal is that those kids are hearing those vowels before they're born.
Exactly. They say by 10 weeks before birth they're listening.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the point is that the more children hear, the better their language becomes.
And one of your points is that boy children don't hear as much as well as girl children do.
No, because their ears don't work, but also because people don't talk to boys. The research is really clear on that. Parents don't talk to boys as often as they talk to girls.
I'm sorry, Rick, we couldn't hear you.
I said maybe dad needs to address mama's pregnant belly.
I think dad needs to talk too. And that's one of the things that I loved about my husband, who would go off with our son when he was changing his diapers, and the two of them would have these wonderful conversations, and they do to this day. And it was a different kind of conversation, but really essential. Good for children to hear everybody talking.
Rick, thank you so very much for your call. Abigail, why don't little boys get talked to as much as little girls?
You know, the research doesn't actually answer that question. My personal feeling is it's got something to do with the fact that boys don't always look at people when they're talking to them. That research is kind of slim, and it's hard to know whether we can actually count on that research, but we do know that boys tend to look at moving objects more than still objects, and if mom's not moving when she's talking or when she's talking, he starts to look at her and then his eyes will drift. And mom assumes that if your eyes aren't glued on you, you're not listening, and that's not true. It's one of the hardest things that teachers have to live with, is that they want all the children. How many times have I been in a classroom and I hear 1, 2, 3, eyes on me, and then the teacher waits until everybody's eyes are on her, and all the little girls are looking at her, and the boys are all over the place, and she wastes time trying to get the little boys all to look. And my point is, they're quiet, they're obviously paying attention, and the fact they're not looking at you doesn't mean they're not attending. So I spend a lot of time trying to get across to teachers the fact that boys listen whether they're looking at you or not.
Next to Afton. Mary, your question or comment for educational psychologist Abigail Norfleet James, please.
Hi. Well, I'm really interested in everything you're saying. I'd love to have you come out and talk at our schools. But my specific question was overhearing. I'm working with a mom now, and I've heard her say to her 3-year-old son, be a man, don't cry. And it just, you know, chills me. But I'm like,
I'm with you.
How do I address that in a way that is supportive of her but correcting?
One of the things that was fascinating to me was I was in a classroom at a boys' school in Pennsylvania, and it was a third grade classroom, and there was a problem in the classroom, and one little boy was aggressive to another little boy. And the teacher, who was brand new to the school, the class came to an end, and she sent everybody out except the aggressor, who then burst into tears. And she was unprepared to deal with this. And it turned out that the child's parents were in the throes of a divorce. He had just found this out. He's totally unable to manage it. And she reacted positively, hugged him, did all kinds of the right sort of things, and sent him off. And she looked at me with this stricken look, and she says, I've never had a child cry. And I said, welcome to a boys' school. They will cry. Boys do cry, and boys need to know that it's okay. One of the things that bothers me is the numbers of people who say, well, I don't want to have single-sex education because children learn stereotypical behavior from each other. And I say, no, they don't learn it from each other. They learn it from adults, because it's parents and it's, you know, it's other kinds of people who say, boys don't cry. Of course,
so
boys cry.
So if you, Abigail, were in a situation like Mary just described and heard a mother say that to her 3-year-old son,
right,
be a man, don't cry.
Right.
Is there anything you would do or say?
I probably would. And when the little boy is not around, what I might do is say, you know, have you learned about, you know, we've got some new information about the fact that boys are far more emotional than we thought they were. And, you know, this is such a great opportunity for you to help your son learn to cope with his emotions. And isn't that a wonderful thing for you to do? You know, give her that positive feedback in sort of oh, gee, did you know there was this new research, which, by the way, isn't that new, but she doesn't have to know that. I fudge a lot that way. But pointing at, you know, because what I tend to do is teach the parent at the same time when I'm teaching the child, and that can help, I think.
Well, I will give it a try. Thanks.
Good luck.
I appreciate it.
Let me know if I can help.
Mary, thank you so very much for your call. One of my very best friends is the father of 5 children. All boys.
Brave man.
And he swears that each one came out of the womb with a distinct personality already set in place.
I would buy that.
Not only that, he says each of his sons is as different from the others as it's possible to be.
Yep.
So to you listening, does any of this resonate for you? Or do you think most boys have some things in common and that parents and teachers could benefit greatly if they better understood those commonalities? Your voice welcome here on Virginia Insight at 888-967-2825. But we only have a couple more minutes to take calls, so please get to the phone right away if you want to join in. 888-WMRA-TALK. Emotions and boys and what we were talking about earlier, Abigail, connection to adults that boys feel affection for.
Yep.
This is all part of the same ball of string, isn't it?
It really is. And it's one of the best things that parents can do for their sons is to give them what is known in the parlance today, authentic emotions. The knowledge that it's okay to be emotional. Now, the point is that boys tend to be emotional in ways that girls are not. Because little boys don't have a lot of words, they tend to be physically emotional. And mothers can see that as being aggressive or mean, when in fact it's simply a way of being emotional. If a little boy says to me, I hate you, I'm likely to say, my son certainly said that to me once or twice, I can remember saying to him, you hate me? Is it really that strong? Or maybe you're just, today you're detesting me, or maybe you're really loathing me. Well, he would start giggling over the fact that we were dealing with different levels of dislike. But what I gave him was an emotional vocabulary, and also admitting the fact that I was asking him to do something he didn't want to do, and he had every right not to be pleased with me. That's one of the things that parents have a hard time with, is that boys are right up front, and if you've done something they don't like, they're going to tell you, a girl's much more likely to say, oh, I wish we hadn't, or I would like it better if, but a boy's like, no, I hate that, I'm not doing that. And the mother responds a little bit higher than she should. You need to back off a little bit and say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, but I'm the mother, and this is what we're going to do. But don't react as if he slapped you in the face. And I get the feeling with some mothers is that because the boy uses language that seems a little more
intense,
right, that she thinks that—
And you say part of that is because the boys have fewer words, so if they're going to say anything at all, it might be short, sweet, and off point.
Right. And please also know that boys, in our culture— anger is the only the emotion that males are allowed socially. It is the preferred not emotion for women. So sometimes a little boy gets angry, and what he really is upset, sad. He's a number of things, but he doesn't know what else to be because anger is all he's seen as an emotional model from other males.
And apparently if he finds a teacher or some other adult in addition to his parents who connects with that, so that the boy feels safe in that environment. One of the things that you're stressing in your book, Dr. James, is that that boy is going to work hard, even on difficult subjects for him.
Absolutely.
For that adult that he feels that connection with.
Absolutely.
I think we've got time for one more call. We're going to Harrisonburg. Christian, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, this is a great show. Thank you so much. I just wanted to say a comment more that I think it's possible to have the best of both worlds. It's hard to do, but my father came from a very traditional background of boys don't cry and, you know, men are tough. And he was able to instill, you know, people ask what's the most important thing that your father taught you. And I'd have to say the most important thing he taught me was how to be gentle. That there's an equal side, and they don't have to be in conflict, is what he always taught me, that you can be a gentle person while also being strong at the right times, and it's not connected to stifling emotions. It's just being in touch with both halves. So I think it is possible for the fathers out there that think it might not be.
Thank you so much for bringing that up, because I'm the more active person in our family. My husband is as your father was. And he is the gentle one, and you're absolutely correct. That is a valuable lesson that men can teach their sons, that being gentle is a masculine trait.
Right. Very much so. Well, thank you.
And you're lucky you had a dad like that.
Christian, thank you so much. You talk in your book about something that I thought was apocryphal, but you say was actually true, of an incident with young elephants in South Africa.
Right. No, it is.
It sort of connects with what Christian was just saying, sort of the flip side.
Yeah. No, that story, I've checked it up several times, and I've actually been to Pilanesberg, which is the animal preserve where it took place.
So tell us the story.
The story is this, that they started Pilanesberg, which is a fairly new animal preserve in South Africa, and they shipped in some animals there, and they couldn't at that point move large adult elephant, so they moved young elephant. And after a couple of years, they began to have a problem that they were finding that the white rhino, who are the mild, sweet, dumb, can't see rhinos, were dying. They were horrible deaths, and they began to realize that some of the young male elephants had banded together in these bachelor groups, as they will, and that they were acting like gangs and picking up sticks and beating the rhinos and stomping on them. And they didn't know what to do, but that by that point they could bring in a couple of big male elephants. And so there's a big elephant preserve not far from this, and they brought in a couple of male elephants who in about 48 hours sorted these fellows. You know, basically using their trunks, saying, you know, we don't act, adult male elephants don't act that way, literally banging them over, knocking them off their feet. And what was funny was
the young male elephants.
And so what was happening afterwards, about 48 hours, was you'd see these big males who are used to being solitary being followed by these young males going, hey, guy, you know, hey, could we play with you? And it was really funny that what they needed was a male model.
And what you're underscoring is that you think it's exactly the same with humans, that especially in our culture at this time, what young boys need more than anything is exposure to other adult males.
They absolutely do. And you watch young males in the company of adults, and you've got to remember, an adult to a 5-year-old is a 15-year-old. And they need older males to teach them this is appropriate behavior and this is not. It's one of the things that I'm always saying to schools is get college students in, you know, who are working with community service, get grandfathers in, get people around to help these boys.
Our guest has been educational psychologist Dr. Abigail Norfleet James, author of 4 books now on sex-based learning styles. Her newest, The Parent's Guide to Boys, Help Your Son Get the Most Out of School and Life. Abigail, thanks so very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. We had extra help today from our old friend Dan Easley. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Juspe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work that Dr. James is doing. If you go to the Virginia Insight Facebook page, by the way, and click like, you'll get access to a whole bunch more information about these broadcasts there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.